Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. This time, I was lucky enough to talk with Peter Mantas, one of the partners of Logos LP. We discussed the healthcare industry in general, and more specifically, the bioprocessing industry. Healthcare is typically an industry deemed by many investors as out of their competence circle. But I'd argue that there are many different sub-industries inside healthcare, with varying degrees of risk, return, and quality characteristics. In today's conversation, we chose to focus on the most attractive portions of the value chain. We make an overview of the industry, discuss the barriers to entry, and also talk about how AI might impact these businesses. But before jumping right into the episode, let me talk about our sponsor, Public.com. If you want to earn a 6.7% yield for the next 4 years or more, you need to check out the bond account at Public.com. It's a new way to invest in a diversified portfolio of bonds and receive monthly interest payments. The best part? If you act now, you can potentially lock in a 6.7% yield until 2028. In other words, no need to worry about the Fed's upcoming rate cuts. With a bond account at public.com, you can earn a 6.7% yield, even as rates fall. It only takes a couple of minutes to get started. But you have to act fast if you want to take advantage of some of the highest bond yields in years. Discover how you can lock in a 6.7% yield until 2028. The new bond account only at public.com/bestanchor. With that, let's jump right into the episode. So, Peter, thank you very much for coming to the podcast. I think it's going to be a great episode where we're going to talk about the healthcare industry in general. But before jumping right into the topic, I'd like for you to introduce yourself and maybe let us know when you got in touch with the healthcare industry and how did your professional career develop?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So I'm one of the general partners of Logos LP. We're a private investment fund, effectively like a family office almost. So we have the advantage of having as permanent capital as one can think of. And we look for companies that have some sort of technological or regulatory capture edge. They're really high quality companies and we like to hold them for very long periods of time. And usually our favorite kinds of investments are where we can find those kinds of companies, but they also face sort of left tail events. So events that are the worst that could happen to them effectively. And so that's what happened in healthcare the last, call it 2.5 years. Yeah, we've been at this fund for 10 years now. Been a while. And yeah, in my previous life, I was a former lawyer and I got into healthcare around 2018, 2019, and I started learning more about the ecosystem and, you know, attended a lot of conferences, specifically like biotech conferences, bio summits, things like that. And also talking to other people and other, you know, managers in the space and specialists. So that's sort of how I eventually got into healthcare. It's a unique industry. I know it scares a lot of generalists or a lot of investors, but it's also one with a lot of opportunity too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your previous experience as a lawyer directed you to the healthcare industry due to the regulatory landscape that you can find in the industry?
Yeah. So I mean, it's a legal background. I used to work at a very big firm in Toronto, Canada, and also doing a lot of corporate stuff, corporate financing stuff. But the detail orientation of that job and just having an understanding of the regulatory background of different ecosystems gives you an idea of what can create stickiness and what cannot create stickiness. Also, reading through documents really fast helps. You know, if you learn that even that practicing law for a bit, yeah, I would say being a lawyer previously is a license is a beneficial for any investment field. Really, it's really about analyzing, absorbing, interpreting information correctly. So mm-hmm. I think that's very useful for any field.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe people who listen to this episode are familiar with the industry, and maybe people who listen to this episode are not familiar with the industry. So I think it's best if we start with an overview of the healthcare industry. I must say that we are going to focus on the healthcare industry in the US specifically, because obviously the healthcare industries are very regulated and they change quite a bit from country to country. So maybe we can first talk about the large, let's say, groups of stakeholders in the healthcare industry, like insurers or large pharma. And I think that would be a great starting point.
Yeah, sure. So the healthcare sector is very big, complex in the United States and Canada. Again, I'm not a tremendous expert on the insurers or managed care, but the biggest players obviously are UnitedHealth, Aetna, Cigna, things like those kinds of companies. And the way, if you want to talk about the biggest, UnitedHealth, think of that as sort of the United States healthcare system. That's the best way to think about it. They not only are the biggest insurer, but will own eventually, you know, end-to-end hospitals, clinicians, doctors. It will be the U.S. healthcare system. It is the U.S. From a pharma perspective, you have the bigs. I call them the big, like, 10. So, you know, your Lilly, Pfizer, Merck, Novartis, AstraZeneca. Those are any companies with over 100 billion market cap. Those are like the big elephants in the jungle. And that's the big pharma guys they're almost similar to very large exploration oil companies. That's probably the best way to think about them. And then you have what I like to call the picks and shovels. So those are life science tools, diagnostic tools, bioprocessing, things like that, where they're I would say the highest quality businesses in the sector. So if you think of, let's say, the semiconductor industry, which is very similar, I would say, to healthcare. These are the companies that are like the fill finishers, chemical suppliers, you know, just material suppliers to the big chip makers, right? So think of like your Applied Materials, your KLA Corp, your, you know, those kinds of companies that have been suppliers to a large part of the semiconductor industry. Those are the bioprocessing companies, the life science tools, diagnostic tools, et cetera. And I would say even in that segment, there's good and bad. There's high quality and not so high quality. But I'm just kind of making a parallel to what is similar to that industry. So I spent a lot of my time on the latter, on the bioprocessing, the picks and shovels, the companies that are a bit more higher quality. Not to say that those other segments don't have high quality companies, but it's just you have to be right more often, especially in big pharma. You have to go through their patent schedule. You have to go through what drugs they have. If you get it right, it could be lucrative. Look what happened to Lilly, right? It's probably going to be a trillion market cap, you know. So you can get it right. And there's also in pharma, there's biotech. Like you have companies that are pre-revenue, pre-drug approval that are going through the trials and hopefully they get an approval. Those are obviously, you know, for a lot of people exciting because they're breakthrough drugs and they can have astronomical returns if there's a big catalyst. But I typically try to stay away from those ones. I follow them only for the purpose of understanding or for getting a deeper insight into the other sectors that I'm more interested in. That makes sense. So like, for example, bioprocessing, we can talk about bioprocessing later, but bioprocessing, a lot of it's driven by biologics. A lot of biologics eventually will be cell and gene therapy. So if you can follow the cell and gene therapy space, who has drugs that are in that area that are very promising or might get approved very soon, then you get a sense as to like what will happen to that sector over time. Or if you know that, hey, there's over 1,000 CAR T cell therapy biotechs in the market right now, then you get a sense of, okay, where this end market might end up going. So I follow biotech for those reasons, but those are like the big segments, I would say, in healthcare. And I typically am more involved in the third segment.
Yeah, let's talk about that segment, right? Because besides being probably, as you said, one of the bioprocessing, I mean, one of the segments where companies can potentially add the most value, it's also expected to enjoy strong growth, right? Due to the growth of biologic medicines. So maybe for people who don't know, if you could quickly explain what a biologic is, and then maybe we could go through the process, maybe a quick summary of the process of the drug manufacturing from early discovery until it's commercialized.
Yeah, so a biologic is something that is derived from living cells. And so there's two kinds of drugs, a small molecule and biologic. Small molecule is, think of a pill, like your a pain medicine, right? Like that's a small molecule, just chemical interaction. Biologic is living cells. So these are, it's like cell and gene therapy. It's your COVID vaccine. It's a peptide, right? Which can be used for, you know, weight loss drugs. So I mean, if these are large molecules, so the molecules are much larger than the small molecule, and they're comprised of living cells. And so when you have biologic drugs have been in existence for a while, but they've sort of taken off more recently with the advances in biologic medicine, especially cell and gene therapies, other kinds of therapies that they're coming on the platform. So the process is a bit different. I could talk about the bioprocessing process. So first starts off with, and then I could talk about how like the regulatory process works.
Mm-hmm.
You have the cell. So first is you have this, once a drug has sort of been, when you have an idea of what you have going on, you have, it starts with cell culture and development. So this is like cell line development, media preparation, lab scale cultivation. Like you're basically preparing the cells you need for what you're about to make. And then it goes to, you know, like I'm going to call the second part like fermentation production. So this is like bioreactors. So that's where you get cell culture growth. You optimize with chemicals, the mechanical manipulation, perfusion. But once you get that done, then it goes into like harvesting, as they call it. And harvesting is, you know, you remove debris and impurities and involves things like filtration or centrifugation. And then after that, you have purification. So this is like multiple chromatography steps, protein A affinity, things like that. And then the final step is fill finish. This is like drug substances that are added to the final dosage suitable for administration. How do you make this drug okay for people to consume? That's mm-hmm. literally the final step. So the big players, from a regulatory perspective, that's bioprocessing, like that's high level bioprocessing. But from a regulatory process, you know, it first starts off with, it's usually academic or university. They might have an idea, like say you and I have an idea for a drug and we're both scientists. And then typically before it's, you, if you come up with something, you go to something called preclinical research, and usually you could do it yourself, but usually you'd hire a firm to handle it or help you handle it. So a company would be like Charles River Labs or Treasure River Labs, probably the bigger one, but there's other ones around. You can even use a smaller one. These are CRO, clinical research organizations. So they help you discover your drug and see if it's going to work, right? Because when you go from preclinical, you want to go to a clinical trial, a phase one, phase two, phase three. Usually preclinical trials are tested on animals to try to eliminate that as much as possible. But the US government has something called the Animal Welfare Act, and it has certain drug regulations where you cannot test on humans if you don't test on an animal. And so we'll talk about AI and AI or digital twinning a animal body so we don't harm them for drug testing, but it's going to be hard to completely replace animal testing just because we don't know for sure if something will, how it will react. But even if you have something digitally, we don't know for sure. Anyway, that's sort of a separate topic. So once you go through the preclinical and you go into clinical trials, and let's say your drug is starting to get more for your phase three, you're about to get commercialized, you have to figure out a way how to manufacture it. Right. And typically sometimes people will start thinking about manufacturing before even phase two, right? They'll build out manufacturing facilities, or they'll hire and contract a CDMO, which is a contract development manufacturer. A lot of the, well, not a lot, but some of the CROs, let's say Evotec and Charles River, they also want to manufacture the drug. And so not only will I help you research it and help you through the process of finding, you know, the how safe this drug is and how toxicology would work against the different biological reactions, I can also help manufacture it for your trial.
And I imagine this is much more appealing for smaller companies, right? Who maybe don't have the funds to invest in a manufacturing line, even if it's before.
Yes. Majority small companies, by small, say under a billion or even 5 billion, will always outsource manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So they'll go to like a Lonza, they'll go to Merck, they'll go to, some of these CDMOs. Lonza and Merck are the big ones, but they'll manufacture their behalf. Sometimes they'll have a partnership with a big drug company, like maybe with Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and then maybe manufacture their behalf and collect some kind of fee for it. But yeah, the reason why you go with these guys is because when you get into manufacturing, there's a whole regulatory process that is really expensive and annoying, so to speak. So usually when you go to a full-fledged FDA regulated GMP facility, so GMP is good manufacturing process, and this is where you have a facility ready to go. Like this is your facility to manufacture drugs. But before you do that, you don't want to make any mistakes in a GMP facility because you can't change it. Like if you have certain equipment there and certain thresholds, like my chromatography system can't be more than, A and B thresholds in fluid, or the temperature for this bioreactor can't be more than this and that for this process. So you have to outline your process. And in biologic drugs, the process is the product. Like how you make it is typically a lot of times companies will test out manufacturing in a pilot facility. Pilot facility is almost like a test track. Think of it like your Mercedes-Benz, and you want to test drive your cars before you start fully manufacturing them. You go to a test track, see how fast they can go. Maybe you crash them sometimes. Like you do all these test tracks. So you have pilot facilities. Some big companies will have their own pilot facilities, and in a pilot facility, it's effectively unregulated. Like you can do whatever you want. You just try to see how quick or how good you can manufacture something. Thermo Fisher has been buying pilot facilities all over the United States so that, smaller companies who want to eventually use a CDMO can test them out in their Thermo Fisher, pilot facility. But once you go from a pilot facility to a CDMO, or you have your own facility, you're locked in effectively. Like you can't change the process, right?
Here's where the expression "spec'd in" comes, right? That you're in the regulatory document, and then if the customer wants to change something of the process, then they have to go, maybe not through exactly the same regulatory process, but they have to go through a lengthy process to change suppliers.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And not only that, but you're also audited by the FDA. So FDA comes in and says, hey, we're going to audit your facility. They find that you have too much debris on the floor, whatever, there can be problems there. They can shut you down. They can, they can fine you. There's a bunch of things they can do that they can reprimand and fix this right away. You have 30 days. So you don't want to be in that situation where your drug is on hold for manufacturing because your facility is not, has been audited and it hasn't passed. It doesn't make you feel good,
Mm-hmm.
So in those manufacturing facilities, you have to say, well, what is the equipment they'll use? Because all that stuff is spec'd in, right? So that's where you're getting into the bioprocessing ecosystem. That's where you get the Danaher's, the Repligen's, the Aventor's, Thermo Fisher's, and Sartorius, anything, all those companies are in those facilities, right? And the thing with these companies, why they are so good is because you don't, these are processes that you don't want to make a mistake in, right? You're not going to switch suppliers because they're doing it cheaper. You'd only switch suppliers because you can guarantee that they won't make a mistake, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So if you look at downstream bioprocessing, which is what I said before, like purification and harvesting and like formulation, things like that, 85% of those drugs are Cytiva, go through Cytiva. Cytiva is owned by Danaher, right? And the reason why you have such high concentration in a lot of these markets is because, again, like mistake making, you don't want to switch suppliers on how sticky it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
The upstream stuff, like I said, like the cell culture and bioreactors, they're a little less sticky, but still sticky, right? So like bioreactors, Sartorius has a very big, high market share on bioreactors. If you want to switch a bioreactor, it's probably going to cost you $1 million minimum. It's going to take you maybe, 36 to 60 months to switch. call, let's say 36 months plus the materials. Like, it's a big pain in the butt, right?
Do the customers tend to multi-source where possible? I mean, like packing in several suppliers just in case. Maybe with COVID and the supply challenges that they had, maybe that trend is now stronger.
They do, especially if they trust the supplier and do really well. Like Rapaligen is a smaller vendor, but they have very good downstream technology for their chromatography columns or filtration. So you might have Cytiva for certain things and then Rapaligen for others, and you might use a Sartorius bioreactor when you go upstream. But you're still switching an ecosystem of very trusted suppliers. Like you and I couldn't start a bioreactor company and say, hey, start using us because we're cheaper.
Yeah, if it's not a monopoly, it's an oligopoly, so to say.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You're choosing one between two or three, maybe.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, that's sort of the way to think about it. And from a regulatory perspective, it's almost similar to, I would say, the people of the stock TransDigm. You know, TransDigm is aftermarket aero parts. Think of it like, you know, if you're United Airlines and you want your planes in the sky, you don't want your planes on the ground, right? You're not going to switch seatbelts because one is cheaper. You're going to go with the seatbelt that you can guarantee will pass an FAA audit, right? And so that's sort of the way to think about with this ecosystem, was forget even just understanding the particulars of any biologic reaction or drug. It's your drug cannot come to market if you have any mistakes in your manufacturing process and if there's any errors in the drug itself, because you can kill somebody.
Yeah. So, I mean, we also have to be aware that pharma companies, maybe they've gone through 100 projects and they are commercializing one, right? That they are getting to the commercializing phase. So obviously, if you don't do well on that one, then you're not going to be able to cover the cost of the rest. And there's a lot of at stake, right? Because you are potentially going to make billions out of a successful drug.
Yeah, that's right. And so that also leads to a good point as to why. So this is why I follow biotech too, and more of a macro follow versus specific, is because the opportunity for the bioprocessing companies, it like tenfolds once they get commercial. Like if you're doing a clinical trial, typically, let's say for a biologic drug, you go from phase one to phase three. Like a phase one is maybe 10 patients. And then you go to a phase three, which is you can get to 1,000 patients, right? So right there, you have an incremental increase in bioprocessing equipment spend. But then if it gets commercial, then it's like another tenfold, more than tenfold, right? And so, and then you're locked in, like you're locked in by the FDA, you're locked in with the regulatory documentation, you're locked in with all the specifications. And so that's where I would say it's important to follow the commercial trends too. Right. So if you look at 2017, there might've been, I think, like 3 cell and gene therapies approved. This year, there's like almost 20. So if you understand, okay, cell and gene therapy is a place where they're spending more money and these drugs are costing a lot of money. You know, cell and gene therapy drugs could be in the hundreds of thousands to many millions. Then you understand where the sector is going to go with the bioprocessing companies. You know, and they all do different things, right? Like Avantor, for example, is more in the fill finish side, and Rapaligen is more on the chromatography purification side, and Sartorius is a bit more upstream. Like they all do different things in bioprocessing, but at a high level, like for people to understand how this ecosystem works and why it is a good segment in healthcare, is these things are very locked in and they have very good pricing power because it's very difficult to change them. And you're not changing on price, you're only changing on fault or error or something's very dramatic.
So let's talk a bit about how they make money, right? Because they sell the equipment, but then, and that's a, let's say, non-recurring part of the business. And then what's that? They have also a very recurring revenue component. So what's that component?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of times when you go through a manufacturing process, you can have single use equipment. So if it's like a chromatography column or something like that, or some other kind of waste that is being generated, well, then you have to have disposables. So the disposables have to happen every time you go through a manufacturing run for a lot of companies, especially in the biology side. And because of these, the regulatory nature of these things and how expensive the drugs are, you get a significant amount of pricing power for the vendor. So I say this in an almost joking way, but they're selling pieces of plastic, trash bags, and metal for tens of thousands of dollars. Like, that's what this is, right? Like, when you waste in a harvesting or purification process, like, okay, you need a garbage bag. Like, I see this, it's like, it's a very high quality garbage bag, but effectively it's a garbage bag, and you're going to sell that for $5,000, $10,000. Or chromatography column is like literally a piece of plastic. Or some in the new ones are metal based, or filtration system is it. Some of the disposables are very small pieces that aren't expensive to make, but they charge a lot of money for them. So there's a lot of disposables when it comes to manufacturing, because you can't have a mistake. You have to make sure the yield is high in the manufacturing process, especially for biologics that are going into humans. Like, the dosage is very important, and it has to be very specific. Like, your output has to be the same all the time. So you have to consume a lot of consumables to make sure that there's no mistakes that process, and you have to make sure that everything is as clean as possible. So there's a big amount of consumable component for this.
So earlier in the show, you heard us talk about our sponsor, public.com. If you want to earn a 6.7% yield for the next 4 years or more, you need to check out the bond account at public.com. It's a new way to invest in a diversified portfolio of bonds and receive monthly interest payments. The best part, if you act now, you can potentially lock in a 6.7% yield until 2028. The new bond account only at public.com/bestanchor. Also, don't forget that you can follow my work and all the research at bestanchorstocks.com. The single-use technology is actually where beneficial, right, to the picks and shovels, because if I'm not mistaken, before there wasn't as much single use, but then a customer every X bioprocessing cycles had to clean all the material, right? So then you have to put a stop to the manufacturing process, and that was also costly. So when did the transition more or less take place to single use? And I think there's been quite a bit of criticism, right? Also to the picks and shovels with this transition, because they are making a lot more money, right? It's been very beneficial for them. And I think people are not aware of the benefits that being single use has with respect to being how the system was built before.
Yeah, it really started to go off in like 2012, 2013, I would say. It's about when like cell and gene therapy started to sort of get a bit more traction. It's really when Repligen was the kind of leader there. And they just better way, more efficient way, cleaner way to get as much yield as possible while also, you know, nailing down your processes. I think single use will be here for a while. So yeah, like, for part of the business model for these guys is not only they sell the equipment, but there's all these disposables that are on top of that. And then many times there's also software, like tracking the yield and making sure that the software monitors certain things in the right way. And so all that software component is another added piece that there's actually more and more software now in these facilities than there's ever been. Right. So, you know, there's always been the question of could you fully automate, like, could you use AI software to fully automate a facility? So no one's been able to do that based on the regulations. But if someone were to figure that out, that would be a very, very high interest to companies like Repligen or to Danaher or to Thermo. To figure it out, like a continuous process that uses AI to correct itself would be very attractive to them. But yeah, like, so that is, it's also a big software component in that whole space as well.
And maybe staying on the AI topic, I mean, AI right now is the buzzword. You see it everywhere. And many people are afraid or maybe want to take advantage of the opportunity that AI might disrupt a lot of industries. I personally think that the picks and shovels of bioprocessing are in a great spot regarding AI, right? Because AI is expected, and this has not only come from pharma companies, this has come from cloud providers like Amazon, right? That many pharma companies are starting to use AI to accelerate the drug discovery process. As you said, maybe it's not going to be as useful in the trials, right? Because even if it's AI, you don't know how a human organism or an animal organism is going to react. So bioprocessing companies potentially can benefit from a faster discovery process, which leads to more volume. But at the same time, they are sort of protected by regulation. So it's very tough to displace them because, as you said, it's not that you have the best technology, it's that you have the trust. And obviously, the pharma company trusts that the process is going to go well. So how do you think, what role do you think AI is going to play in bioprocessing?
Yeah, that's like I said, the golden egg for AI and bioprocessing is anything that is digital twins focused, anything that does continuous improvements, continuous manufacturing. So imagine you have AI, because you're spending a lot of money on a facility. Let's say you're a CDMO or let's say you're a drug company. If you can sort of have like an AI, you know, map out what a perfect facility would look like, and you save a lot of money building one, or you have AI helping you do continuous improvement within the facility so that you get the most amount of yield. Like if you know, for example, when to switch your chromatography column, right? Like specifically, that would be very useful.
Or so more like predictive, right? Rather than reactive.
Exactly. Yeah. Or like I said, the golden egg would be like, if you have certain thresholds that are being used for some kind of bioreactor or for some kind of centrifugation process, the AI automatically like turns the knob, right? Like it fixes it in the process, like as it's doing it, right? Mm-hmm. That hasn't been developed yet. Like that sort of, that would be, if someone could figure that out, they would make a lot of money doing it. But it's very difficult to do it because just the regulatory nature of like these FDA audits and, you know, how much will the FDA allow it to happen in a good manufacturing facility, right? Because if there's a mistake, then you have a big problem. But what kind of, who's going to monitor the AI? Like, you know, do you have AI monitoring the AI? You know, just who's going to make sure that works well? And how can it be? Can someone do it truly automatic? Like, can someone do it without human intervention? So that's, I think AI and bioprocessing is going to be a bit more obvious. It's not going to be like something tremendously game changing. Like if you think about like surgery, for example, like there is a world where you can get a fully automated robotic surgeon, you know, maybe the guy monitors it, but it's like a surgeon monitors it, but it's, there's a world where like you have just machines doing a very specific surgery, you know? In the drug development side, it's unlikely you'll have machines completely doing the processes without any humans involved. And even surgery, like you'll have like a neurosurgeon or, you know, a regular surgeon watch the machine. You know, in bioprocessing, I think it becomes a bit more difficult. I think the best you'll see right now is sort of just more predictive as to making sure that they get the best kind of yield in those areas. And maybe you can figure out the lifespan through different disposables and cut costs. The easiest thing for AI is more of the preclinical stuff. So like drug discovery, safety, maybe toxicology, maybe, you know, it's still not clear that's the case. Like the thing with AI needs a lot of data. And companies like Charles Rivers, even Icon, they'll have a lot of data in the research models. And so you can try to figure out like what drug might work, what drugs might not work, how will this interact with the human body. You can get an idea of what that would be. And maybe AI helps for that process. You can figure out like biologic reaction for drug discovery. You can kind of get an inclination of like, hey, this drug will probably make it to phase two based on AI, you know? And so for a lot of drug companies, that's very valuable. Like if they know which will win and which will not win, or which will get to phase three versus not, that's very helpful. You cut a lot of errors out. But all that is sort of more on the drug discovery. So that's very early stage stuff. That's more like earlier on. The bioprocessing is sort of really starts to kick in like phase, like call it phase two. You have a pretty big trial now and like you have, there's likelihood or, you know, you're semi-confident that your drug will get approved. But you just got to start planning on the manufacturing side of things. How is this going to look like? Right. So that's where the bioprocessing starts to get. But I see AI mostly, the easy pickings would be the sort of earlier drug discovery and questions around finding genetics, answers to genetic questions, things related to sort of discovery of new therapies, I think is probably the easiest. Right.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about the picks and shovels like Danaher, Repligen, Thermo Fisher. I think another very interesting, let's say, part of the value chain is, as you mentioned, fill and finish, right? Which basically consists of taking the drug and putting it in a cartridge or in a vial or in a syringe so that it can be distributed. Here, if I'm not incorrect, there are two pretty large players. Probably the most famous is West Pharma, right? That is one of the famous compounders in the US. So what do you think makes this part of the value chain so valuable?
Yeah, so there's fill and finish. There's two major areas. There's the packaging and the, you know, like the filling of the drug into a vial or syringe, that's West. And then there's like, well, is there any chemicals that need to be added so that the drug don't like separate in a syringe or like don't like explode, you know? That's Avantor, AVTR. So West is interesting because, you know, they make all the parts on the delivery side. So like think of your vials, your stoppers, your, you know, the syringes, things like that, right? And so typically their business model is simple where they will manufacture whatever you need and then they'll add services on top of that because the area is very regulated and very expensive to correct. Customers want to make sure that syringe doesn't break, the file doesn't break and kill somebody, right? So they add these services on top of that at like 90% gross margin. Like that's really the business model. They're not going to jack up price on a syringe. Like it's theoretically, if you need a really good syringe, you need a really good syringe. You can charge dollars and you make it for pennies and you need it because it's regulated. But what they typically do is they'll typically price, you know, 3-5% increases every year and then get you on the services. So like that's where you get 90% services margin.
And those services, I imagine, are related mostly to how clean the syringe is or how safe it is to put the drug in, right?
Like quality control, manufacturing control, like things like that, where you need to make sure that this is going to work. Or the vials, I care. A lot of biologics will be in vials as well. So that's another thing you want to make sure of. West also has a contract manufacturing. So like if you have a very special syringe that you want or you know, delivery mechanism that you want, they can make it for you. That's a lower margin, but again, services on top of that. So West is going through a unique phase where, so you had the COVID. I mean, there's many things that are going on right now, but you had COVID, which is effectively a biologic, and that created an incredible boom in the stock price and business demand and everything. And the margins are very high in biologic business. So they have a division called High Value Products, HVP. And that's more for like biologics, cell and gene therapy, things like that, where it's large molecule. The more advanced the cell or the technology, the more they use their higher margin products. And so you have also their other business units, which is, like I said, like just regular drugs, like single molecule drugs, less, a little lower margin. But so during COVID, you had a boom in this HVP line because you were delivering many billions of COVID vaccine. So margins went up, revenue went up, free cash flow went up a lot. And then when you had rates go up and then COVID, not many people taking as much COVID vaccine, then you had destocking as well. Like people ordered a lot because they didn't really know what was going on with supply chain because you closed the economy down. The stock dropped and then it rose again because of the weight loss drugs, GLP-1s, right? And so they own like 90% share of those drugs. Like they supplied Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly in that area. And so, yeah, that was, again, their high value product. And now as those become generic over time, or if someone comes out with a pill, if someone comes out with a weight loss pill, as an example, you don't need that HP line. You need just regular pill packaging. So their margins go down. So it's they're in a very, like how you say, unique. Last 4 years have been very unique, right? You had a pandemic, then you had this incredible, the biggest drug potentially in mankind, weight loss drugs. While at the same time, you have cell and gene therapy sort of brewing under the water, right? So in a world where, let's say, you have a large percentage of therapies are biologic drugs, biologic therapies, yeah, like West will benefit because long-term, it's going to focus to have them more on HVP line or greater. There's even more advanced delivery solutions they have, which are more expensive. So gross margins go up. Even margins go up. Like it's a business that will always have that pricing power and margin growth. You know, as the more technologically advanced medicine gets, the higher margins they can deliver. So think of them as like a tax on American ingenuity, you know,
And I mean, these companies are investing very heavily, right? I mean, you look at West is, I think, around 70% of CapEx is for growth. And I think in the case of Stevanato, I think it's closer to 90%. I mean, we're talking about Stevanato, I think it's a $5 billion company. And for the last couple of years, they spent close to $500 million in a CapEx program that obviously has brought their free cash flow to negative, and they've come out with debt and everything. So I think it's really remarkable to see these companies after COVID investing so heavily into capacity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's because you have to think of it like the railways, right? You have to sort of lay down the rail tracks before the trains start running, right? But once the tracks are laid down, all you're doing is watching the trains go back and forth, right? And so right now they're kind of in a unique position where, okay, there's this long-term trend in biologic drugs. Call it cell and gene therapy, call it whatever. You know, like if you have a cellular gene therapy for Parkinson's disease, which has a huge amount of patients, you better have the infrastructure ready, right, to go when that needs to get manufactured and go through that whole process. A lot of these companies are, like West, are kind of laying down those tracks right now because they don't want to be spending that money when they're needed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like a lot of their businesses, they're in the stickiest part of the business, of like that segment. No one switches as a supplier for a stopper, a syringe, or a vial, or things like that. So they just want to make sure they can deliver to their customers as much volume as possible for things that are going to come. So yeah, like these are very long duration markets. And so, like I said, just similar to a rail, you just want to lay down the tracks. And then you can see the train coming for the next, you know, call it 25 years. So that's why they've been spending a lot of capital in the space so far, just to make sure that they can deliver the customers are asking.
And as you said, these businesses are, well, rely on injectables, right? So if one thinks, I think I read recently that biologics is tough to make them pills because then the protein might be destroyed once it goes into your stomach. So injectable is the way to go. Do you see that changing anytime in the future? Maybe we have some innovative way of, I don't know if I remember reading that there was a biologic that was distributed through infusion, maybe, that you put in on top of your skin and then it went through? Do you think that's a long-term risk for these companies, or do you think that injectables are going to be like the go-to distribution method for biologics?
I think like companies will always try to figure out if there's a way that they can successfully deliver certain biologics in a pill, because people will always want to take a pill versus syringe. I think it's a very hard problem to solve. But yeah, I think it could be possible. I mean, anything's possible, really. But there's also the second issue, which is risk. So what I mean by that is, if you take a certain kinds of biologic drugs, have certain delivery mechanisms, biologic delivery mechanisms associated with them. And so for sometimes you don't want a lot of that delivery mechanism hitting different parts of your body. So for example, in gene therapy, you usually deliver the gene therapy through a virus, like an AAV vector, usually sometimes like a herpes virus or something like that, where you actually take that virus to deliver the therapy to the body. But sometimes you have a therapy where you don't want that virus hitting your liver or your kidney, or you want to be very localized, right? And so sometimes the only way to do that is through direct delivery or through, you know, more higher dosage. You have to get the dosage right. And with pills, it's very hard to figure out the right dosage, because you're involving many steps in the body. You're involving like stomach, digestion, you know, and how do you make sure that the right amount gets the right area for the therapy you're asking, while not losing anything in the digestion process? Like it becomes a harder problem. So I don't think you'll see a world where like you don't have any syringes, especially for things in the neuro space. Like there's areas where you have the blood-brain barrier, for example, right? That's just like a Chinese wall. It's very important. You can't have things in the blood go to the brain. But if you are delivering something in the specifically in like the frontal cortex of the brain, or like in the putamen region of the brain, like very specifically, but you don't want the rest of the brain touched, you're going to need something very specific. You're going to need like that injectable or something very specific to deliver to that very specific region in a very specific amount. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll ever see, well, we don't have injectables. But if someone could figure out, let's say, a weight loss drug with a pill, yeah, that would be very good, right? It's a very hard problem to solve.
I think one of the probably most interesting things about this industry is that you have, let's say, you have large pharma in the middle, and from one side, they are super innovative, right? They're coming up with all of this, like medicine is advancing really fast. But on the other side, which is the manufacturing side, they are like super conservative, because obviously there's a lot at stake and they're spending a lot of money in their innovative side. So obviously, and we've discussed through this hour about these companies that benefit from this conservatism. But as you said, there are oligopolies, monopolies, but very few players. If you were to recommend to an investor here to take would you recommend taking a basket approach? Or what do you think differentiates the different players in the value chain? I mean, what would you focus on to see what company is better than the other, when basically both are, let's say, covered by similar barriers to entry?
Yeah, it's a good question. Without knowing anyone's personal situation, the way to think about it is, at the top, like the most conservative you can get is Thermo Danaher, right? Mm-hmm. Like think about Thermo is really like the shopping mall for pharma, and Danaher has now become a solely life science focused company where they command pretty significant market share in one of the best areas in bioprocessing. Like there's very little that can go wrong if you're kind of betting on, like, those are your healthcare physicians, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Other than macro or something absolutely crazy, like the US government nationalizes like Pfizer or something crazy, like it's very, those are like, I think they're almost like defense contractors, you know, they're like Lockheed Martin's or the Northrop Grumman's. Like they're almost too big to fail, if that makes sense. Like they're very important. So if you don't know anything about anything, like, and if that's the case, you shouldn't invest in space. But if you want to be very more conservative, I would say those are probably the top ones. And then just depends how kind of spicy you want to get, right? Like if you want to have more, a spicier exposure to bioprocessing, there's Repligen, there's Sartorius. If you want to have a little less spice, a little pill finish, you have Avantor. If you want to just focus on delivery, you have West. If you want to focus on preclinical, you can have Charles Rivers, or, you know, Icon is a bit of everything. IQV, just clinical trials. So there's so many different pieces to it. It just depends what kind of exposure that you want. If it's just bioprocessing, then it's just those big ones, Thermo, Danaher, Repligen, Ventor, Sartorius, those ones. They'll all move the same. You know, it's that what changes is the degree of the spiciness, if that makes sense. Yeah. Sartorius will, you know, that's in, it's in Europe too, so there's other issues there, but it will be far more volatile than a Thermo Fisher. Repligen will be more volatile than a Thermo Fisher. So the way I think about it is, imagine you're making a plate or you have a recipe for a stew or something, and you just want to know how spicy do you want it, right? Like That's the real question to think about. And if you want to add a lot more spice, there's many other smaller companies in life science tools and, you know, think even that are complementary to those big players, but you have to worry more about the durability of their business, you know, whether their business is a commodity or not, things like that, where it becomes a bit more of a trick to it, right? So if you like look at the sequencing companies, like genetic sequencing, think of like your PacBios or Illumina's back in the day, or I think there's a lot of companies in that space. Like, how fast can you read sequencing? I don't like those spaces too much because they're more of a commodity. Like, there's no regulatory. Like, if you and I wanted to start a drug company, we need to figure out a lot of data. We need to figure out the genetic makeup of certain cells, right? Like, doing a lot of lab work. Like, things that are more in the lab are less regulated, right? Mm-hmm. So if they're less regulated, then there's less pricing power. There's less of a moat, I would say. And so there's more competition, and they eventually be commodified, right? Like, you don't really care what kind of sequencing tool to read something is. You just want to make sure that's good enough and it's fast. But you do care the kind of vial or syringe you have, because that could kill somebody. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, like, you can get more, like I say, you can get further out in the bioprocessing space, I would say, into more like the life science tools, like this drug discovery tools. I typically don't like to get that far out because, unless it's absolutely blown out, but I'd like to stick with the companies that are a bit more higher quality.
And you talked about, well, throughout this conversation, we've talked a lot about regulatory capture, pricing power. Something that always comes to my mind, I mean, the government / regulatory bodies have created this sort of natural monopolies or oligopolies for these companies. And these companies obviously are taking advantage of their pricing power. Do you think that we, with the problems that there are related to healthcare costs, that we will ever get to a situation where pricing increases maybe have to go through a regulatory body, or the government is maybe stepping back some capability to push on price increases?
Anything's possible. It's a good question. I'm not really sure. I would say that would, sure, the government can do anything. It's possible. Anything can happen. I just don't think it would work. The more you try to control this industry, like especially on price, like if you want to control drug pricing or you want to control their kind of pricing, the more expensive things get, because people, companies and actors and just agents will just not supply things, or they're not going to be forced to go into a business that they don't think is going to be that profitable. So you might get supply issues, you might get, especially supply issues for something that like can save a life. And the other thing too, is if they're not making good, you know, free cash flow, especially the drug companies too, then there's less of an incentive for them to do discovery, come up with therapies. Like, all these ecosystems, they're just one big tax on American science. And so you have to be bullish on American science, or science in general, right? And if you control the scientific industry's ability to make profits off some of this stuff, then there's less of incentive for them to do scientific endeavors. Like, they're just going to do less research. They're going to do less discovery. They're going to do less early stage stuff. And so I'm always against any controlling on price. I think, like, all these industries, they go through these massive cycles, right? Eventually generics hit and then they get undercut significantly, right? Like in biologic drugs, the generic market will be pretty big, biosimilars, right? Which are similar to biologic drugs, and they'll make them for much cheaper than the biologic drugs will. And so you're already going to have price reduction, and, you know, there's going to be more supply. If there's more biosimilar manufacturers and there's more supply of equipment, then they don't have to have as much price increases. You know, I don't think the price increase control will work, if there is any. And I also don't think that the price increases are that crazy. Like, you're talking about high single digits, mid single digits. Like, it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's above inflation, but it's not tremendous unless there's a massive supply shock. I don't really see it happening long term. But again, like, anything can happen.
Well, I think your point is a good one, right? Because if you institute price controls, then the companies are less incentivized to have very stringent quality controls, right? So at the end, you are making it cheaper, but also less safe. And obviously, you're dealing here with human lives, right? Or maybe with the inability of having a treatment maybe for many more years because people are not incentivized to put money behind that idea. So I think that's actually a great point. So thank you very much, Peter, for coming. I think it was a great conversation. I think a lot of people who don't know the industry, and maybe people who do know the industry, are going to get a lot of value from this. So thank you very much.
No, I appreciate it. Appreciate it for having me on and talking high level as to the ecosystem and where the trends would go in the future.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
For sure. Have a good one.